CFM.
When I grew up as a boy, I lived in Midwest City, which is right outside of Oklahoma City. I went to Midwest City Monroney Junior High School, which had just been built. We were the first students in that school. Nobody locked their doors. I never knew a girl that got pregnant. Never, ever, not once. Never knew anybody who was divorced. Never knew anybody whose home was robbed. We lived in a different world than we live in today. Everybody earned a living. Everybody who wanted to work had a job. I don't care who it was.
Yes, the audacious attack on New York and Washington by Islamist terrorists. Or is it the big lie of the millennium? We're doing a special on the September 11th attacks today, and it's really, I suppose, an antidote to the royal wedding. ...9/11 attacks in danger of turning this 21st century into a century of perpetual war, normalising the policy of regime change, targeting a country's resources and government, then cooking up any old excuse to invade them. The relevance of 9/11 today? Well, NATO's Anglo-Zionist Empire has been sending special forces into Syria and Iran to train terrorists. They're violating international law. Where it's politically difficult, we just hire Blackwater, or whatever they and their friends are called these days, to do it deniably on contract. In the studio tonight, we have author of 9/11, New Evidence, Ian Henshaw, and also Oxfordshire-based retired engineer, author of a new report on the collapse of Building 7, Dave Barmby. You're going to be hearing in a minute from stewardess Rebecca Roth, who was so incensed with the 9/11 lies, she did her own investigation, which she produced as a book called Methodical Illusion. And before Hollywood director and candidate for governor of Arizona, Aaron Russo, died of cancer 10 years ago, he spilt the beans on secret conversations between himself and banker Nick Rockefeller, who told him in the 1990s about elite plans for the world, including a 9/11 style event leading to the invasion of Afghanistan many years before it actually happened. Plus, finally, on the Israeli connection, the Jewish former head of the studies at US Army War College, Alan Sobrowski, who believes the Israeli mafia control many key US institutions, including the Congress. Our sister show Dialects, back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, Karen Passmore from Bristol Disability and Equality Forum, which is losing much of its funding under Mayor Marvin Rees, talks about the horrific survival of the fittest effects of universal credit and why it directly linked to the explosion in homelessness in Britain. Dialect on BCFM next Tuesday at noon, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. Before we go back to talk about 9/11, Martin Summers, we've had a horrific week over in Palestine, haven't we?
Indeed, and of course this is all related to the main topic of this programme about 9/11, because of course there is clear indications that Mossad had some hand in what went on. It's not just the Western Intelligence Services, CIA, MI6, etc. And the five dancing Israelis were seen dancing on top of a van when the first plane hit, and they were videoing it. They were then arrested later, 8 hours later, because somebody took the number of the van, and it turned out they were all Mossad agents, and they were held for some while, and then eventually released and sent back to the US to Israel after about 40 days or so. They went on TV in Israel and said, yes, we were Mossad agents, we were just documenting the event. But of course it was they were filming the first plane hitting the first building.
Weren't there art students? Were they art students?
Well, the art students is another aspect of this. The DEA were investigating a huge ecstasy smuggling.
Drugs people.
The Drugs Enforcement Administration, a huge ecstasy of Israeli art students who were going around pretending to sell art, but in actual fact using this as a cover cover for infiltrating various sensitive military installations and so on and so forth. And I think the copper's hunch about this is that the Israelis, the Americans, and I think the British were all involved in 9/11.
Now, going back to this week, the figures are at least 58 dead on Monday, Palestinian protesters, and up to, I've seen various figures saying up to 5,000 injured and hospitalised. Now, many people from Palestine have now having to be shipped over to places like Egypt to receive medical attention.
Well, I think what you've got to recognise about all of this is that Israel doesn't actually have any recognised borders. They themselves have said, we don't have any recognised borders. That is not an international...
Recognised by whom?
No, the Gaza Strip is not an international border. It's a ceasefire line from 1948, and when it was agreed that it was a ceasefire, it was then agreed that people would be allowed to go back to their farms and houses. And of course, most of the people in Gaza used to live in the other, on the other side of the wire, in the land that's been seized by the settlers who have settled it subsequently. But the Israelis are presenting this as a protection of their border. Of course, they're overwhelmingly force. You know, there's no Israeli injuries at all, so they're not any kind of threat from these protests, so they've just gunned these people down ruthlessly. But the fact is, that is not an international border, and that what's happening now is there is no two-state solution. The Americans have recognised Jerusalem as the capital, therefore it's back to war between Palestine and Israel. And of course the Israelis have got no leg to stand on morally when that war comes, and eventually you may see a push by the Syrian army, backed by the Iranian and the Russians, to retake the Golan Heights, which of course are not part of Israel.
Okay,
even though they're full of oil.
The United Nations today, we've heard UN Human Rights Body calling for an international inquiry in Gaza, although I don't know quite why you need an inquiry about what's happened. It's all pretty obvious what's happened there. Gazans, apparently, according to the UN, are caged in a toxic slum from birth to death. The new UN Human Rights Chief says that. And Jerusalem blasts the anti-Israel council. And Turkey has been ripping into the United States for defending Israel and must be held accountable for the massacres of innocent people.
Well, in other words, we're going to a major Middle East war, and of course the Israelis will have to fight Hezbollah in Syria or possibly in Lebanon, where they've just won the election. But it's not clear that they can beat Hezbollah, because in 2006 Hezbollah thrashed the Israeli defence forces. I mean, and they're much better organised now than they were
can
then.
You see why the
so
Israelis,
if the Israelis go to war with Lebanon, they're going to lose.
Can you see why the Israelis might object to the UN using language like Gazans being caged in a toxic slum from birth to death?
There's no reason why they can't object, because that's the situation. There's a blockade on Gaza, so they can't get any food or anything. And it's been the military dictatorship in Egypt is backing up the Israeli position, and you've got a younger generation in Gaza who've literally got nothing to lose. And you remember the film Gandhi, where they marched towards the salt and they were being beaten down with lathes and so on? That's exactly what they're having. This is non-violent. The Gazans have decided to go for non-violent protest, and that means that they're prepared to die to bring this to a head. And it will be brought to a head, but ultimately it may well be settled not through non-violent protest, but a war between Israel, Hezbollah, Syria, Iran and Russia, and the Israelis are going to lose. Netanyahu was actually at
not if the Americans join on the
Israelis. Well, no, well, but the Americans might find out who did 9/11 between now and then, mightn't they?
Well, what, tomorrow?
Well, that's going to be part of the war. General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, have made it quite clear that the Russians always knew what happened on 9/11. And when it comes to a fight, then one of the first things they're going to do is drop all the things they've got on onto the, everybody will be told what they know.
Okay, so let's get back to this week. And Mark Regev is the Israeli ambassador to the UK. He was on Channel 4 News, and here he is responding to Jon Snow's questions about why it's necessary to be shooting people who are apparently unarmed, apart from maybe some with stones, and injuring up to 5,000 just this week.
We have civilian communities immediately adjacent to that border. We have farms, we have townships within half a kilometre, a few hundred metres from that border. It's our obligation to protect our civilians. And let's let the Hamas people speak for themselves. They said, the leader of Hamas said, the goal is to penetrate into Israel. He said, to cut out the hearts, to kill the Israeli civilian population. Obviously, we have to protect our people.
Yeah, but that's the sort of sloganizing that you are very used to from Hamas.
We shouldn't take those threats seriously, John?
So perhaps we shouldn't take the UN seriously when they say an attempt to approach a crossing or crossing the fence does not represent a threat to life or serious injury. They are not sufficient grounds for the use of live ammunition.
We would say the following. If you are trying to cross into our country, destroy the security fence, and you've declared your goal is to kill Israeli civilians, I think that's a threat that we would be irresponsible not to take seriously.
It's not an international border, as I pointed out earlier, and in actual fact, the Israelis have got no right to say that this is a border and we're going to defend it in this way. And in any case, what's going to happen now, the Hamas have really come to the understanding that they can't actually fight there. They're not going to fight. They're going to carry on using non-violent tactics. But of course, Hezbollah, the Syrian army, the Russian army, that's another story.
So where is this heading, Martin? Brief, that's finally on this news from this week. Where are we going?
What was interesting about this, Netanyahu invited himself to Moscow for the May the 9th victory parade. And I think what Putin is trying to do is he's trying to get the Israelis to back off on a war on Syria and Iran. And he's trying to get the Iranians and the Syrians to compromise with the Israelis to prevent a war. But of course, if it looks like the Israelis are dead set on a war, in which case I hope that Hezbollah are going to bloody their nose.
The simple question, why?
Why? Because they've got an expansionist ideology, a bit like Serbia in the 1990s. And of course, we went to war with Serbia, which the Israelis didn't support, and killed thousands of their civilians to make them disgorge Kosovo. And of course, Sharon didn't support that because he understood the implications. Now, we've just put in no-fly zones over Libya, no-fly zones over Iraq. If the Israelis attempt to use air power against civilian population of Gaza, I would argue the RAF should shoot them down.
Okay, so much of what we're talking about tonight seems to be connected with the Middle East. Back to you, Ian Henshaw. You're the author of 9/11, the new evidence. What about the Saudis? Because this is one of the things that does bother me. Now we've got an alliance with Saudi Arabia supplying with massive amounts of weaponry, and yet most of, apparently, even all of the hijackers apparently were Saudis.
Well, that's true. Not all of them, but I think 15 out of 19. But, when you start investigating and looking at the paper trail, the first place you get to is the Saudis, and the second place you get to is the CIA. Now, Israel, you know, I think the best model to understand this is not to think about the CIA. There's lots of different types of people in the CIA. We're only talking about a very small number from the CIA operations department. The Pakistanis, there's quite a lot of evidence to show that they had a hand in 9/11 as well. So what I think you're looking at is a sort of group of people taken from each of these agencies. Everybody, I think, had a look in, but only in their sort of very secret sort of parts of so you know, we can't say Pakistan helped create 9/11. We can't say Saudi Arabia did quite, although with Saudi Arabia there is a lot of evidence that actually the government did support those alleged hijackers in the United States. One problem is that the 9/11 truth community is sort of split between the people who don't believe the hijacker story at all, in the same way as a lot of people don't believe the towers story. Nobody who's looked at it believes it. A lot of people say, well, you know, that you couldn't have flown the planes like that. We don't really believe the hijackers existed either. But the problem there is that they would have needed patsies. So even, and patsies are sort of people to blame who aren't really responsible. So the problem is that they did need these patsies, whether or not they flew the planes into the towers. And the evidence is that the pilots that they designated as being the pilots, that the FBI designated as being the pilots, they could not have flown those planes. They did not have the flying skills. And that's a matter of that's on record from the training companies whose job it is to train pilots. They had these guys in training and they were hopeless. They couldn't even fly small planes, let alone big planes. Another problem with the hijacker list is that they've got two captains, two genuine airline captains in one plane and none in another. So it looks as if somebody made a little bit of a mistake on faking the paperwork there.
Interesting. Well, that's certainly feasible. Anyway, one person that's had quite a good look at this and actually come out with a book called Methodical Illusion about it is the former stewardess, air stewardess, American, Rebecca Roth. So let's have a listen to her. And here she picks up on some of the stuff you were talking about there, Ian.
There's a passenger on flight 175. That's the second plane that left Boston's Logan. And he said, there are two things that passengers said. One of them said to his father, I think they're going to, well, first he said, they've stabbed an airline hostess, and that's something we've never been called in the United States. We've been stewardesses and then flight attendants since the late 60s. Airline hostess is what El Al uses, some Middle Eastern and some Asian and some European airlines will use airline hostess, but not here. And so I had to look to see who is this guy, how old is he? Is he 85? Is he from Germany or is he from Israel or is he from Japan or what? Actually, he was just an American. He was only 32. Since the time he was maybe 5 or 6 years old, we in the air had been called flight attendants to him in every news report, every magazine, every story he'd ever seen, any flight he'd ever taken. We would be called, have been called almost his entire life flight attendant. So I thought, well, what a weird what a weird combination of words for him to use. That's really weird. It's like someone told him to say that. And then I started to put down all the words that were used, and there was, all of the calls were very scripted. And so they needed to be, because if you look back right now, I know we're all embarrassed, that those of us that are waking up are kind of embarrassed that we were manipulated.
These are the calls and from the aircraft to the ground.
And really, really we were. It was master manipulation. But if you look back now, remember those flags were everywhere. Flags came out of everywhere. And these guys on Flight 93, let's roll, heroes. All of their wives were given huge book contracts right away. They made a Hollywood movie out of Flight 93.
Yep.
And so what we were looking at was like a Super Bowl. And if we hadn't had the details that came in from those cell phone calls, we wouldn't have known they were Middle Eastern descent. And we wouldn't have known they had plastic box cutters and that's how they did it. And we wouldn't have known all of the things that we found out from those cell phone calls. And if it were really Al-Qaeda, they'd have taken that plane out of Dulles and got into that cockpit on takeoff, and they'd have crashed it into the Pentagon within 5 minutes. No one in their right mind would have pressured themselves up against NORAD, the U.S. Navy, the Strategic Air Command, and our system that was supposed to be in place and fly around for an hour or an hour and a half. They wouldn't. Nobody would do that. That's insanity.
Oh,
and
it
so,
is.
And I mean, we remember the golfer who had a medical condition and passed out at, and he was flying. They scrambled jets in 6 minutes, and I've had jets scrambled on me before. They happen really quick. They are pretty close to your wingtip, and it's frightening as heck, I have to tell you. But anybody that had any knowledge at all of our defense system would have known that. So why would they take off from Dulles, which is right across the river from the Pentagon, and fly all the way almost to Cleveland or so, and then turn it around and come back and go into this 270-degree corkscrew turn that was impossible for a 757 to be flown at, and then just so happened to meet head-on with the Office of Naval Intelligence, where they were actually investigating Enron, World Crossing, Global Crossing, and the missing $2.3 trillion. Why would terrorists care that those investigations were going on?
Yeah, really.
How would they know? And if they knew about that, they sure as heck knew that NORAD would scramble jets, then they wouldn't be choosing to fly for an hour and a half before they crashed into their site. So I started just using really common sense. And I had no political agenda. I had no religious agenda. I had no agenda but the truth. And so when I started down here, I started digging through this rabbit hole, I like to say. I just went until I found the truth. And what I did was I used my common sense and my airline knowledge. And then I started to see that we were actually asked to believe that on Flight 11, on American Flight 11, the first plane out of Boston, coincidentally, actually had on board not a federal marshal, but an Israeli Defense Forces Special Operations Sayer at Met Call, highly trained assassin, and he was also trained as an anti-hijacking specialist, and he was trained in hostage rescue. His friends said that he could kill anybody with a credit card and a pen And yet we are to believe that he was killed by a 5'6" Arab terrorist, 20 some years old, that plotted this hijacking, sitting right behind him in business class, along with another guy. And this guy, the Sayeret Metcal assassin, was actually fluent in English. He grew up in Denver, Colorado. He was fluent in Hebrew because he moved to Israel when he was 14, and he was fluent in Arabic. So he probably could hear those guys right behind him. And if you've anybody sat on an airplane, you know that if people are sitting behind you and they're talking, you're hearing their conversation, mm-hmm. unless you're wearing some good Bose headphones that you can't hear the jets or anything else, right? So here he was, sitting in 9B on Flight 11, trained assassin, trained anti-hijacking coordinator, and actually fluent in the language that the hijackers were speaking in the row directly behind him. And he allowed himself to be killed by a quarter-inch blade on a plastic box cutter.
Well, also, the other thing that's interesting about this is it wasn't possible to make mobile phone calls from aeroplanes in that era. You can do it now, but at that time, you couldn't. And, of course, they then tried to finesse that by saying, well, in actual fact, it wasn't a mobile phone. It must have been the in-flight phones, which, of course, you have to put a credit card into.
Something like 3,000 feet, you can make mobile phone calls, even though you're not supposed to.
Yeah, but they're at 30,000 feet.
Good point.
And, of course, the other thing is, how believable, even if you could make such phone calls, how believable is it that people would give a running commentary on a battle they're fighting with terrorists on the mobile phones while they're doing it? Would you do that?
Ian Henshaw, I wonder what you make of Rebecca's point about the planes flying so far around, miles away from their targets, literally halfway across the US and back again.
Well, you know, what would they say? I think it's always worth listening to what your opponents would say. They'll say, well, you know, maybe they took a while to pluck up the courage. Maybe they had to wait till the pilot's door had been opened. But she's right, basically. It is bizarre. And the other thing that's worth mentioning is that, because there was a lot of discussion straight after 9/11 about the failure to scramble planes to intercept the hijacked planes. And they gradually botched together an official story which says that the planes were accidentally, by coincidence, all on manoeuvres in Canada as part of an exercise, and that's why there weren't any planes around. Which doesn't sound very plausible to me. There were some planes around, and there was a particular airbase that was never even asked to put planes into the air until about 2 hours later.
What about her point there about whether there really were any Al-Qaeda hijackers?
Well, I think that's a very open question. I can't tell you what I think it's. They certainly weren't the hijackers who were named by the FBI. That's beyond any doubt, because Hanihan Jor, the alleged pilot of Flight 77, was considered unsafe in a small plane, and he's allegedly fed a new destination into the autopilot and successfully taken over the controls to fly at full speed at ground level into the Pentagon. Now, any pilot, if there are any pilots out there, could I just make an appeal through your good offices here, Tony? I would love to hear from a pilot whether or not it is possible to reprogram an autopilot so that a plane will totally U-turn and go back to where it started from, which is the official story for how they got the planes. Because, you know, it's difficult to know how they even navigated the planes.
I think Rebecca's great. She comes from a very, very sort of down-to-earth point of view, comes across extremely well. She does talk about something, a corkscrew turn there. Tell us about that. What the plane that went into the Pentagon did?
Yeah, it did a turn. It did a long turn, a long descending turn. I'm not an expert, but they do claim that it is feasible, the official story people. I don't know if it's feasible or not. But certainly the people in the Pentagon in the civil controllers who physically saw the plane with their eyes, they said they thought it looked like a military plane.
And what about this aspect of various big investigations going on, that suddenly the offices where those investigations happened were demolished by these aircraft?
Well, not only that, but of course World Trade Center 7, it's not just the Pentagon. World Trade Center 7 was carrying out had officers that were carrying out the investigations into the Enron collapse, which George Bush and Tony Blair were up to their eyeballs in that. So George Bush would have been very, very relieved when those documents were destroyed in World Trade Center 7.
Okay, let's hear a bit more from Rebecca now, where she talks about evidence, well, absolute concrete proof that the FBI were lying.
as Americans, we were traumatized. So we were going to believe anything that we were being brainwashed and led to believe that day. And so since we were so blown away and not really paying close attention, the FBI originally had four names on this list of 19 hijackers. One of them ended up being an FAA aviation safety expert, an employee of the FAA in Florida. And his last name was Bukhari, and his brother, that the FBI claimed was on the manifest. This is their saying. These are the guys who were on the manifest. These are our hijackers. Now, this information came out within 12 hours, probably, of the planes crashing. So he shows up at the FAA and says, "Wait, no, I wasn't a hijacker. I'm alive. I didn't get on the plane. I didn't buy a ticket. I didn't have a thing to do with it." And his brother, who they claim, the FBI now is claiming, they know who the hijackers are. And here's two of them. They're brothers. His brother had been dead in a small plane crash a year earlier. Wow. And so he said, "My brother couldn't have been on it either because he's dead." And then the two other gentlemen, I forgot their last names now, showed up. Also at their local FBI, and said, "No, here's our alibi. This is what we do for a living, and we weren't a part of these airplanes." So they quickly changed the story, and the Bukhari brothers actually owned originally the Mohammed Atta rental car story with the Quran and the flight logs, or the flight bag and all of the will and testament. That whole entire story originally belonged to those two brothers. So they just switched out with Mohammed Atta with that. That's just crazy. And I don't think many people really know that. I didn't ever find that until I'd actually finished the book.
I mean, I think the shocking thing about a lot of this, Martin Summers, is that the details, if you actually start looking into them, just simply don't add up at all.
No, well, as I said, General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, and he's still around, he's retired now, he made pretty clear in stuff he said on the internet, we knew what was happening all along. We've always known. And, of course, that's going to be decisive in World War III.
Now, one of the other people that has commented quite a bit on the September the 11th attacks is he's dead now. He's a former producer and director in Hollywood. He also owned nightclubs. He stood to be the governor of the state of Arizona, I believe, or maybe Nevada, not sure which, maybe, because actually Nevada's Las Vegas. That's quite a big state to be running. And as a result, he was approached by Nick Rockefeller, the banker, and from the banking family. And here is Aaron Russo describing what Nick Rockefeller had to say to him, because apparently Rockefeller told him about the September 11th attacks before they ever happened.
I met Rockefeller through a female attorney I knew, who called me up one day and said, one of the Rockefellers would like to meet you. I had made a video called Mad as Hell, and he'd seen the video and wanted to meet me and knew I was running for governor of Nevada. So sure, I'd love to meet him. And I met him and I liked him, and he was a very, very smart man, and we used to talk and share ideas and thoughts, and he's the one who told me 11 months before 9/11 ever happened that there was going to be an event. Never told him what the event was going to be, but there was going to be an event, and out of that event, we were going to invade Afghanistan to run pipelines from the Caspian Sea. We were going to invade Iraq, to take over the oil fields, establish a base in the Middle East, and make it all part of the New World Order. And we go after Chavez in Venezuela. And sure enough, later 9/11 happened. And I remember he was telling me how how you're going to see soldiers looking in caves for people in Afghanistan and Pakistan and all these places. And there's going to be this war on terror, which is no real enemy. And the whole thing is a giant hoax, but it's a way for the government to take over the American people.
He told you it was going to be a hoax.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no question. He says, there's going to be war and terror. And he's just laughing. There's no... Who are we fighting? I mean, why do you think 9/11 happened and then nothing's happened since then? Do you think that our security is so great here that these people who pulled off 9/11, who were able to, can't knock down another plane? Come on, it's ridiculous. 9/11 was done by people in our own government and our own banking system to perpetuate the fear of the American people into subordinating themselves to anything the government wants them to do. That's what it's about, and to create this war, this endless war on terror. And that's why we. And that was the first lie. And the next lie was going into Iraq, you know, to get Saddam Hussein out with his weapons of mass destruction. That was the next lie. So it goes on and on forever. And they can do whatever they want. They scare the hell out of the American public. Look, this whole war on terror is a fraud. It's a farce. It's very difficult to say it out loud because people are intimidated against saying it. Because if you say it, they want to make you into a nutcase. But the truth has to come out. That's why I'm doing this interview. The fact of the matter happens to be that the whole war on terror is a fraud. It's a farce. Yeah, there's a war going on in Iraq because we invaded Iraq. And people over there fighting, you know. But the war on terror, it's a joke, you know. And until we discover what really happened on 9/11 and who was responsible for 9/11, because that's where the war on terror emanates from. That's where it comes from. It was 9/11 that allowed this war on terror to begin. And until we get to the bottom root of 9/11, the truth of 9/11, we'll never know about the war on terror.
Yeah, Martin, Aaron Russo there is talking about this war on terror being a farce, a fraud. He's talking about, he's saying that he's got this from someone called Nick Rockefeller. Is he credible?
Well, I mean, I'm inclined to believe what's said. Going back to what I was saying earlier, there's actually a track record of NATO intelligence services engaging in false flag terrorism, particularly in Italy during what they call the Strategia di Tensione, the Strategy of Tension, which began in the 1940s to prevent the Italian Communist Party from getting any share of power in Italy. Got into high gear at Piazza Fontana in 1969 when nine people were killed in the Banco Agricola in Milan, and of course subsequent police investigation showed that far from being anarchists who were given the blame at the time, it was in fact the intelligence services who planted the bomb.
9/11 is one whole big step up from that.
It is, but the point is it's the same. What is the moral difference between killing 86 people at Bologna in a bomb which was planted by the NATO intelligence services, or killing 3,000 plus in the Twin Towers?
You could also almost say those were sort of practice operations, but there is another practice operation, and that is called Operation Northwoods, isn't it?
Well, Northwoods was exposed by Freedom of Information request. It's in James Bamford's book about the NSA, and anybody can look it up. I mean, the top brass of the US military, led by Lyman Lemnitzer, basically put together a plan to they were going to bomb airliners, that they would be faked, it would be blamed on the Cubans, and then they would invade Cuba. And I just saw earlier on the news feed here that a Cuban airlines plane has just crashed at Havana Airport. A Boeing 757 has just crashed at Havana Airport as we've been on air. Now, of course, if I was the Cuban intelligence services, I would be asking questions about why is our airplane blowing up? Because, of course, the 1964 Northwoods was exactly about that. And it went to McNamara, who was, Kennedy's fixer, and he said, well, this is bonkers, we're not doing this. And they threw it back in their faces. But all the top brass in the US signed off on it, that they would kill their own people, blame the Cubans, and then invade Cuba. That's how they were thinking in 1964.
From what Aaron Russo is saying there, Ian Henshaw, he's really painting a kind of Orwellian picture, saying that this is a potentially this war on terror will last forever.
Well, it would. I mean, that was Cheney, you know, the vice president at the time. He said, you know, beyond our lifetimes. And that's right, of course. You can't ever win a war on terror, so there's never going to be an end point. That's one of the huge benefits of it for the arms industry. But I think another thing it might be worth taking into context here is something that people have pretty much totally forgotten about, the Oklahoma bombing, which happened in 1995. And it was at a time when with hindsight, they were getting ready for the war on terror. And everybody in Washington was bemoaning the fact that nobody was worried enough about terrorism. Then the Oklahoma bombing happened. And it was blamed on Islamic terrorists. And they actually arrested the ringleader in London. The Brits are always very cooperative with these things. Well, of course, we now know, or we think we know, that it was Timothy McVeigh, an ex-American Special Services guy, and they soon dropped the Islamic terrorists side. Timothy McVeigh was caught by accident by some local FBI people. So I don't think it's completely wild to speculate that Oklahoma was a false flag that went wrong, and they learnt from that. One, get the official story out right away. So that's why you need the Patsy hijackers, so as you can explain why you're blaming Al-Qaeda. Oh, because there's some Al-Qaeda people on the plane. And that's, you know, that's the official story. And B, do it big. You know, even Oklahoma wasn't that big. Oklahoma's not that near anywhere. New York, you know, they did it big. Nationals from dozens and dozens of countries died in that, so all those countries could be involved very easily in the planned war on terror. And you know, that's the thing, is do it big and people will be more intimidated, more shocked, more likely to swallow the story than if you actually do it small.
Okay, is it true, let's get back to some of the details of 9/11, is it true that none of the aircraft were intercepted on 9/11?
Correct.
None.
No.
Extraordinary.
There was a lot of speculation about that at the time. But the interesting thing to me is that Donald Rumsfeld, the then defense secretary, changed the rules about 3 months before 9/11. And you won't hear this very often. A lot of people in the 9/11 truth movement don't seem to be aware of this. He changed the rules in two ways. One, police enforcement people on planes, I think they were called air marshals, were stopped from carrying live ammunition. So that's very useful if you're running the 9/11 attacks. It means that none of these alleged hijackers are going to get shot dead by an air marshal. And the second way they changed the rules was that the Secretary of Defense had to give permission for a hijacked plane to be shot down. So that's particularly weird, because the Secretary of Defense is not actually in the chain of command. And so when it came to examining the details of what went on in the chain of command, what you found was that all the messages went into a black hole in the Pentagon, which was due to the fact that nobody could find Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld had put himself in charge of coping with a hijack, and when the hijacks happened, he wasn't anywhere to be found to give his approval to anything. So, you know,
so
I think that's really suspicious.
Where was he?
He was going out giving first aid. He walked out. He ignored the first message that he received in a meeting. His aide has said that. After about 15, 20 minutes, he went out the back to be photographed by the media, so-called helping deal with the casualties, which looked great. You know, Rumsfeld with his sleeves rolled up, helping with the casualties. If you didn't know that he was supposed to be in the situations room, giving the orders to intercept the planes and, if necessary, shoot them down.
Amazing. Also, some of the mainstream media have come up with something recently called the Looming Tower.
Yes, that's very interesting.
What is that?
Well, it's the story of how the CIA blocked the FBI from foiling the 9/11 attacks.
Hang on. So is this a drama about the conspiracy, the cover-up?
Yeah, it's described as a docudrama, and these FBI guys are very pissed off, excuse my language, are very angry about this. They've been talking about it ever since pretty much the day after 9/11. It's not just one or two of them.
Because there was actually a kind of rupture in the FBI at the time of 9/11,
absolutely,
wasn't there, with the deputy director actually being killed in the attacks and being sacked just before.
Well, the guy who would have been in charge from the FBI side had been driven out of the FBI in the months preceding, and he'd just been given a job. His name's John O'Neill. He'd just been given a job as head of security at the World Trade Center.
So when you say he was driven out, why? How?
Well, it's complicated, but basically he was accused of disciplinary improprieties, and they made his life so miserable that he decided to resign.
Is this the guy who was actually trying to pursue some of the people who would eventually carry out the 9/11 attacks?
He went down to Yemen to... there was an American ship was sunk by Al-Qaeda, holed, badly damaged in an attack in Yemen.
Yes, yes.
And John O'Neill went down there as head of an FBI delegation, and the CIA absolutely hated him. And then later, when 9/11 came up, it turns out that one of the bosses of the FBI is actually a CIA guy on secondment from the FBI. It gets complicated. The basic message is that the FBI, if you believe the official story of 9/11, then the FBI could have stopped the 9/11 attack.
So
and they were obstructed by the CIA,
so
very
this
actively obstructed.
This is good officials being thwarted by criminal officials within the structure.
Yeah, that's right.
O'Neill wrote a book, or was interviewed for a book, by Brissard and Dasky, who were French former intelligence agents. And he said at the time that he was after Bin Laden, but he was constantly prevented from carrying through his investigations.
Yeah.
There are quite a lot of films, internet films, not been shown on the BBC about this. And I came across one which I was quite impressed with. And it is, although the title I wouldn't necessarily agree is accurate, it's certainly got lots of interesting facts in it. The film is called 9/11 Conspiracy Solved: The Names, the Connections and the Details. So let's have a little listen to a clip from that now.
On September 10th, 2001, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion in unadjusted funds were missing from the Pentagon budget. The very next day, the offices whose responsibility it was for tracking that money down were destroyed when American Airlines Flight 77 impacted that very section of the building. The only off-site backup for the Pentagon's black budget financial records was a secure federal office building in the World Trade Center complex. Strangely, it too was destroyed on 9/11. World Trade Center 7 was the largest CIA headquarters outside of Langley, Virginia, and housed offices involved in several large-scale federal investigations into massive stock market and accounting fraud. Not surprisingly, World Trade Center 7 was the first to be cleaned up and the evidence destroyed at Ground Zero.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that it was the first to be cleaned up. But, of course, access to Ground Zero was very, very limited. And we now know that the dust at Ground Zero contained millions and billions of circular iron spheres, tiny circular iron spheres, which can only come from vaporized iron. And, you know, that's one of the big issues that we didn't touch in earlier when we were talking about the collapse of
the
Twin Towers.
Well, please do now, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, where can it come from? This is in that American National Geographical Survey that found this. It's undeniable. In the business, they talk about World Trade Center dust as a unique phenomenon, but they, for some reason, don't want to ask about how those spheroids could have got formed. The original FEMA investigation also found evidence of molten steel, which once again should not have happened. It would only happen if there were explosives or incendiaries of some sort. It wouldn't come from an office fire.
Okay, so what about these? What's been going on to cause these amazing World Trade Center iron spheres? What's that?
Well, it's got to have been something very, very hot. You wouldn't get that from jet fuel. I mean, we'd be speculating. Some people have speculated that it could be thermite, which is an incredibly effective high temperature incendiary. It's not an explosive technically, I believe.
I always remember actually watching the black and white version years ago of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The very first episode, there's a thermite explosion in it, which is used to this was, I suppose, stuff that the military were playing around with in the 1960s, and new types of explosives. Martin, what is thermite, and what how's it involved with all of this, do you think?
Well, I'm not an expert in these matters.
Dave, what about you? Have you got any thoughts? No, okay.
But I mean, there are others who are experts.
I understand that it burns very hot.
Well, I mean, you've got Niels Harrit, who's a retired chemistry professor from Copenhagen University, and Steve... What's his name?
Steve Jones,
and they've got peer-reviewed academic papers which found nanothermite in the dust from the World Trade Center, and that's indisputable. Now, what the implications of that are, people can make their own conclusions. But these are two respected people, and they've done everything proper in the scientific world to get this stuff out there, and it's been peer reviewed, and there's no doubt about it. Nanothermite was found in the dust, which implies that nanothermite was the explosive. Which, of course, the only people who've got that are the US military. Nobody else has got it.
Well, we've only got 10 minutes or so left now, so let's go to have a look, I suppose, at some of the speculation around and evidence around who did it. And one of the people who's had some fascinating stuff to say about that is a former head of Director of Studies, that's right, at the US Army War College, Alan Sobroski, who is from a Jewish family himself. So, in a way, it's probably better to have him talking about these matters than someone who isn't Jewish. But anyway, here he's talking about the influence of various people, including dual US Israeli citizens, on the official bodies that were supposed to be investigating the 9/11 attacks.
When I was in Washington at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of our visitors for a luncheon talk was a young gentleman then named Francois Heisberg. Heisberg was the special assistant to French President Francois Mitterrand. And I don't know how this subject came up, but he said, you know,
Americans never see conspiracies anywhere. We French, he said, we see conspiracies everywhere. And both of us are wrong. This is not a conspiracy in the sense that it is usually used, the word is usually used, which is to denigrate an opposing argument. When someone in the United States says that that's a conspiracy or that's a conspiracy theory, by definition, they mean it is irrational, illegitimate, and without proof. All I would suggest to people is that you look at the films of WTC-7, that third tower going down on September 11th. You look and listen to the reports on September 11th with the secondary explosions. These are not fantasies. They happened. You look at the reports on September 12th of the apprehension of Israelis with vans of explosives and cameras filming the events on September 11. These are not fantasies. And you look at the people riddling the American government, all of the Middle East people in State Defense and the National Security Council, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith, who used to be a friend of mine, by the way, from Philadelphia. These people were all part of the neoconservative movement. Many of these people are dual U.S.-Israeli nationals. All of their primary allegiance is to Israel. I don't much care about other people or other countries. I don't hate anyone in particular. I don't like anyone in particular. I'm an American. My loyalty is strictly to the United States. And I don't care what my ethnicity is or what my ancestry is. My allegiance is that. And my concern is only whether something helps or hurts the United States. And I think anyone who's a citizen of any country can very properly have similar feelings toward their country. What I'm concerned about is what is done to hurt America. And it is very clear that over a period of the last 40-odd years, that the penetration of the American political process, the effective subordination of the Congress in particular to Israel, when an Israeli prime minister can get 29 standing ovations from a Congress that can't give that much support to one of their own presidents, no matter how outlandish the statements, you have something as close to a puppet agency as you're going to find. Our policy in the Middle East has for decades been manipulated increasingly in terms of what benefits Israel and not what benefits the United States. Even when that policy is articulated and supported by individuals who are sworn officials of the United States government. And to me, when a sworn official of the United States government, whether or not that person has dual Israeli citizenship, manipulates American policy, contrives crises and tragedies like 9/11, contrives wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, and now tries to get us into a war with Iran, all in the service of Israel, spending American lives in that process, they commit high treason. And they need to be treated in that manner.
Well, I think that's very telling. I remember when I first came across his views some years ago, because, as he says, he's a Jewish ethnicity, but he doesn't make much deal out of that. But it's basically, it is treason. And ultimately, of course, as World War III develops, the fact that the people in charge in the US are traitors is going to be decisive, because they're going to be stabbed in the back even as they go forward.
But surely all this
is why they're going to lose.
All this talk about World War III is just scaremongering.
No, we're already in it. We started on 9/11, and of course people have been dying in Syria over the last 7 years, where the British, we've got evidence that the British orchestrated the uprising in Syria working with the Americans, so we're responsible for all those deaths. And ultimately, of course, the 7/7 attacks here in this country, Netanyahu got a warning, so he didn't turn up to a meeting that morning because somebody told him that there was going to be a bomb attack in London, which means that possibly Mossad had a hand in that, okay. In which case they killed 50 British people on that occasion, And I would suggest that it's about time Britain went to war with Israel, not for Israel. And of course, that's how it's going to play out when it comes down to it.
Ian Henshaw, what about your thoughts about what 9/11 means for us today?
What it means for us today, I come back to an old-fashioned word, imperialism, actually. I think America was getting isolationist, which is a very bad word in the lexicon of the elite, especially here in Britain, Europe and Israel and the Middle East, because they want American involvement. They want American weapons to so-called protect them. So I think, you know, the Brits are actually, you know, as another of the groups who did have a hand in it. I'd say it's a very small part of the Brits, just like perhaps a fairly small part of the Israelis.
Well, we had the BBC. We heard about them, didn't we? knowing about World Trade Center Building 7 collapsing.
That was just a cock-up.
I don't think they were, that woman was participating in it particularly. But the BBC just does whatever the government tells
us to do. But the thing is that they haven't held their hands up. This is the problem, isn't it, afterwards?
Yeah, they won't admit anything. Can I just mention one thing? I was invited to give a talk at the Oxford Union, which is probably one of the most famous and high-profile debating societies in the world. Very American. There's lots of American students at Oxford. Lots of potential and future CIA people go to. And the American embassy was told, we're getting Ian Henshaw, who's a 9/11 skeptic, is giving a talk to the whole. There were hundreds of people came to this talk, almost 1,000 people. And the American embassy was invited to send somebody to debate against me. I'm not the blooming smartest person in the world by any means, you know. They wouldn't send anybody. They wouldn't even go to the Oxford Union to defend the story of 9/11. And I think that's just amazing.
Well, I mean, I did a 9/11 programme years ago on Commonwealth FM before this radio station ever started. And all the American embassy would do was send a written statement. They wouldn't send anybody. We wouldn't give anybody on the phone or anything like that. Anyway, what's the state of the 9/11 truth movement today? Because I know you've had this meeting in London this week, for example.
Well, it was a big successful meeting. I think to some extent, to be perfectly honest, we were preaching to the choir, you know, to the converted. But on the train back, I got into conversation with the train guard, so that's pretty random, and he said that in his opinion it was completely obvious that World Trade Center was brought down by explosives, and he thought everybody knew that. So I think the people who are the most difficult to persuade are the people who believe everything they read in The Guardian or Channel 4 News or the BBC. You know, and these are the people who've been telling these massively obvious lies lately about the chemical attacks the alleged chemical attacks in Syria and the alleged nerve agent attack in Britain. And you can say they're lying because they're not looking at obvious flaws in their argument. You know, the Guardian had 3 pages on a plane shoot down in Ukraine a couple of years back without ever discussing what possible motive the Russians would have had to shoot that plane down. So, you know, people who won't operate fairly and give any airing to different opinions, especially when they're so well supported by facts, have got to be seen as essentially dishonest.
Martin Summers, this often does come down to the mainstream media, doesn't it? And I've heard just today that Ofcom may be taking this show off the air at some point in the future, that there's some sort of process that they're going through to see if that may happen. It all comes down to the mainstream media, doesn't it? And there's very few programmes like ours out there.
Well, indeed. And, of course, I do work with Russia Today, as you know, and there's been suggestions that they should be taken down. But, of course, the reason they're saying that is because they can't answer the sort of things that we say. And, of course, if they do that, then BBC won't be allowed to operate in Russia. Of course, BBC Russia were the ones who did interviews on the ground when MH17 was shot down, with locals saying, well, we saw a plane from Kiev shoot it down.
Well, it might be a little bit
That went up on the BBC website in Moscow, and then the BBC in London shut them up.
It might be a little bit cheeky, but I'm just going to ask any of our listeners that appreciate what we do here, please write to Ofcom and say something about it, because we don't want to be taken off the air. Thank you very much, because we're one of the only people, I think, you're getting both sides. I mean, I try and put the opposite point of view to you guys, and also we're hearing from people like the Israeli ambassador too. So, I mean, what I like to see is balance, and I don't see a lot of that in the mainstream press. Anyway, Ian Henshaw, Dave Barnby, Martin Summers, and also we heard from Richard Gator. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be with you next week. In the meantime, I'll leave you with something from 1966.
tell you what I'm gonna do, 'cause I love you, yes, I love you. That's no secret. Everybody knows how I feel. It's no secret when I say my love is real, 'cause I love you, yes, I love you. It's no
is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.